Welcome to Bioethics in the Margins. We are a group of bioethicists from different institutions across the country. This podcast represents our views and those of our guests, but we do not speak for our universities or medical centers, nor for any formalized bioethics organizations. Our mission is to bring marginalized topics and voices into the bioethics discourse. This podcast is hosted by Dr. Amelia Barwise, Associate Professor of Medicine and Assistant Professor of Biomedical Ethics at the Mayo Clinic, and Dr. Kirk Johnson, Assistant Professor of Justice Studies and Medical Humanities at Montclair State University. Please enjoy this conversation.
So, hello, and welcome to another episode of Bioethics in the Margins. We're so excited to have Dr. Shamika Thomas with us for this particular episode. Dr. Shamika Poetry Thomas is a research faculty and provost scholar on the tenure track at The Ohio State University's College of Medicine in the Department of Biomedical Education and Anatomy Center for Bioethics. Her research focuses on global bioethics, non-invasive prenatal testing, reproductive genetics, sickle cell disease, and advancing health equity among Black and African populations. She recently completed the Fogarty International Global Health Fellowship at Harvard University School of Public Health. She also found and led a project called Sickle Cell Women and Girls Project of Accra, Ghana, otherwise known as SWAG as the acronym. And this was at the Institute, well, the Ghana Institute of Clinical Genetics, where she lived abroad in Ghana, West Africa, for 12 consecutive months. Dr. Thomas completed a two-year postdoctoral fellowship intramural at the National Institutes of Health, National Human Genomics Research Institutes, focusing on patient perceptions of genetic technology among Black women with genetic conditions. Dr. Thomas's dissertation was also nominated for the Most Outstanding Dissertation Award in 2020. Currently, she serves as the Vice President of Beyond Global Health Organization and is on the editorial board of advisors for Springer Nature's Maternal and Child Health Journal. So a huge welcome to Dr. Thomas.
Yes, thank you so much. It's such a pleasure and an honor to be here today. Happy New Year, everyone, 2025.
Absolutely. Our first podcast to kick off the new year. So we're so excited and glad to have you.
Yes.
So we always start off with amazing guests like yourself to ask the question, how did you end up in the field of bioethics? What was your career path that led you here?
Yes, it's been such a interesting journey. I would say it's not linear, but it has been a little bit more like a guidance. I've been guided along the way. So I am formally trained as a medical sociologist, and I have training also as a reproductive health scientist. But my work has largely been fundamental around the curiosities of ethical, legal, and social implications, or ELSI research. So after completing my postdoctoral fellowship at NIH and Genome Institute, I became very, very intentional and adamant about focusing on reproductive justice, reproductive autonomy, and also investigating the lived experiences and patient perceptions of Black and African women across the African diaspora as they intersect or navigate or negotiate reproductive genetic technology. So I am definitely here for bioethical considerations and bioethical awareness, but I'm definitely making sure that my research is raising awareness around sickle cell disease and the ethical considerations of genetic technology.
No, absolutely. That's quite interesting and fascinating. What, I guess, personal experience or any part of your journey that you had that bug to really go into bioethics? Was it something that a friend, something happened or experienced with a friend, family member that's like, you know what, or personal, if you don't mind sharing, that's like, you know, I really want to go into bioethics and I really want to focus on maternal health, particularly for Black women. So basically, what is your why?
Why
did you go to school, and why did you go through the process where you are currently are right now, presently?
Absolutely. So I've always been an ethical or justice-oriented health researcher. I graduated from Spelman College and I studied abroad at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. And while I was in South Africa, I also participated in a health organization called Chakro, which we went to local villages and local townships to work with different types of organizations related to HIV and AIDS, as well as maternal and child health disparities. So I've always been very, very adamant about understanding the lived experiences and patient perceptions of people in the African diaspora. After finishing Spelman College and finishing my PhD at the University of Miami and my dissertation, I became very, very curious to continue to expand my work. So the word for me is expansion. I believe this is why I'm in bioethics, because I'm very, very interested in how we can expand our reproductive lens to understand the reproductive capacities of those who are navigating critical and chronic conditions such as sickle cell disease. Currently in the field of maternal and child health, we are limited in our understanding of sickle cell disease. And then when it comes to genetics, in the field of genetics, they're limited in maternal and child health. So we need these fields to speak to each other, to face each other, to embrace the implications of each other's experiences for patients and how patients navigate these different domains. And so my work cuts across these different intersections, and I am building up my research to have more translational models that can speak to not only the lived experience, but also providing patient education as well as provider education and tools for understanding sickle cell and reproductive health capacity.
Yeah. And what's interesting, I'd like to hear your thoughts on this. What are some of the reasons why you think this is such a limited, constrained understanding of this particular field? Do you think it's based off of historical dynamics? Do you think it's based off of funding? Maybe all the above. Why is it so, it's a clearly really important particular field. Why is it so limited, you think?
Yes, absolutely. Such a powerful question. First and foremost, it is definitely hegemonic and historical. When we think about structural barriers, structural racism, also obstetric racism, we have to also give honor and credit to the bodies of Black women who have been used and exploited in the name of science and scientific development. So, for example, former enslaved Black women's bodies were used to advance medical care. Henrietta Lacks herself were taken from her body without her informed consent, and her cells have went on to produce so many different innovations for different types of conditions, such as polio vaccine or hydroxyurea, which is a treatment for sickle cell disease. So when we think about Black women's bodies, we think about books like Killing the Black Body by Dorothy Roberts, and we understand or try to grapple with the reckoning of racism in this country, we have to also understand what this means for the reproductive experience at the clinical encounter as it relates to Black bodies and mental health. So my research going forward has really tried to understand the intersection and the lack thereof around these domains. And I like to call this an issue with siloed care. In the U.S., we currently operate in a system of fragmented care systems, where our systems, our health systems are so fragmented, and we have patients who are so deeply reliant on these healthcare subsystems and healthcare specialists to navigate their lived experience. So, for example, a Black woman who is pregnant, who has sickle cell disease, she's not only going to see her OBGYN, she's not only going to see a hematologist or a genetic counselor or a mental health specialist or a clinical psychologist, she's also negotiating and navigating what this means for her family and what this means for her community as well as what it means for her and her own vicarious traumas that may come as a consequence of these fragments. So how can we work together so that we can alleviate these gap areas for patients who have to navigate across these different silos so that we can fundamentally have more integrated care as these patients are transitioning from pediatrics or transitioning to OBGYN care as well as genetic counseling?
Yeah, absolutely. And And I'm assuming, and correct me if I'm wrong in this, but I'm assuming that experience that you just alluded to really has a lot to do with the non-invasive prenatal testing. Because I know, of course, as you mentioned, your work focuses on the reproductive health for Black women, and of course, the non-invasive prenatal testing for sickle cell disease. But even before we go into that specific demographic regarding illness, for our listeners, can you please explain, first of all, what is non-invasive prenatal testing for those that don't understand, and how does it enhance or complement other methods of prenatal genetic testing?
Yes. So non-invasive prenatal testing, or NIPT, or NIPT, or NIPS, is a screening test. It is not a diagnostic test. So for example, a diagnostic test like the amniocentesis can determine if someone has a genetic condition or a genetic abnormality, such as Down syndrome or chromosome condition, so to speak. When it comes to NIPT, NIPT is predictive. It gives you a predictive result that can be false negative or false positive, but it is a diagnostic screening test. When it comes to sickle cell disease, we're at the very beginning stages of using NIPT to screen for sickle cell disease and genotypes. So far, it is not FDA approved, but it is CLIA approved in certain clinical laboratories and used as routine prenatal testing. And we're in the experimental phase with NIPT and its advancements for sickle cell disease. And so my research at NIH, and I'm not speaking for NIH, but my research at NIH, we developed a clinical vignette study where we investigated how Black women with and without sickle cell disease can hypothetically negotiate and navigate with NIPT for sickle cell disease. So we're at the very forefront of what this means in the United States as it relates to understanding patient perceptions, clinical decision-making, and NIPT uptake.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, before I hand it over to Dr. Barwise, my wonderful colleague. So this, NIPT, for short, non-invasive prenatal testing, it sounds like it does, obviously it's in the early stages of technology. And of course, like all technology, eventually will continue to progress and be more sophisticated. But it sounds like this is something very promising for other particular methods of prenatal genetic testing. No, or is it something completely constrained to just, sickle cell disease?
No. So just to clarify, NIPT is already clinically available in the United States, and it has been clinically available as of 2011. It's been marketed on the clinical market in the U.S. It has been a screening test that can screen for Down syndrome or trisomy 21, 18, or 13. It can also screen for sex chromosome abnormalities. So it's already been something that pregnant populations are interfacing with when they receive their early trimester routine prenatal care services. Now we're in the developmental phase or the experimental phase for utilizing NIPT to screen for sickle cell disease in the fetus using the maternal plasma or cell-free DNA. So what that means is that when a woman goes to her prenatal care appointment in the first trimester, she's offered, let's say, an NIPT test. In this case, speaking for sickle cell, an NIPT screening test for sickle cell, they would use her maternal plasma or her blood to screen to see if the fetus would have sickle cell or sickle cell trait. This is at the very, very early stages. So again, it is not FDA approved, but laboratories are experimenting with this. And what my research did was develop the first study of its kind in the United States that examined how Black women with sickle cell and without sickle cell might perceive this particular development for NIPT and sickle cell disease. So we're already, NIPT was already screening for other genetic abnormalities or genetic conditions, but now it's being developed to do the same sort of screening for sickle cell. The ethical issues around this, though, is that the rollout for NIPT and its establishment as a part of prenatal care in the United States, we have very limited perceptions of this genetic technology when it comes to Black women and Black women with sickle cell disease. So they're implementing these genetic screening tests without analyzing and examining how patients with these very conditions are experiencing these genetic technologies. So that's where their ethical dilemmas come up, is that we're implementing these screening tests without asking the patients who are experiencing these conditions how they feel about these genetic screening tests.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying that. So I think it would be really helpful before I want to dive into how you did your study and all the methods that you used, but can you just give us an idea of an adult with sickle cell disease, a woman, whether she's pregnant or not, what kind of symptoms or medical conditions she's going to experience and how she's going to get managed at the hospital? Because I know there's a lot of data, you know, that saying that, you know, pain is underestimated by providers and things like that. So can you sort of just give us an idea of what having that condition would be like for an adult, and then just to give us context. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Good question. Thank you. And all of good questions here. Thank you. So yes, just to give you some statistics here, Black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die from prenatal complications in the United States compared to white women. And this is for preventable complications. And when a woman has sickle cell disease, she's 6 to 10 times more likely to experience death from prenatal difficulties. The intersection of reproductive health and sickle cell disease increases the likelihood of pregnancy loss, preterm labor, as well as maternal mortality for women. And some of these attributes have a lot to do, and quite frankly, most of them have a lot to do with the structural barriers, as well as the limited medical training that providers are receiving in regards to the intersection of reproductive health and sickle cell disease. So for example, I had one patient in my study, she explained to me this dynamic. She said she's pregnant, she goes to see her OBGYN, who was referred to her as a high-risk specialist. But this high-risk specialist had very limited knowledge of sickle cell disease. So she spent most of her time at her appointments having to educate her provider on her condition, which posed even more of an emotional burden for her when she went to her appointments. Then when she goes to see her hematologist or goes to the sickle cell clinic, she's dealing with different providers there, clinicians who may not know about pregnancy or prenatal care and maternal health dynamics that she might be experiencing, you know, if she should take a certain drug, if this interferes with the baby or the fetus, her blood condition, blood clots, things, so to speak, of that nature. So she's torn between the two services or two specialists. And oftentimes, a lot of the reporting, when it's reported, there's underreporting or misreporting. And so patients are kind of passed through these different silos or these different fragments, and it's creating much more of an emotional dilemma. So with my research, I'm analyzing the lived experience of that. I'm asking patients, how do they feel when they're navigating these different aspects or these different silos, and what does this mean for them? And a lot of the results have leaned toward their mental health has been challenged. They feel fear that they might lose their lives. One of my patients, she even mentioned that she felt suicidal. Suicidal really stuck out to me. We definitely have clinical psychologists who are collaborators with us on our studies who can speak to the mental health of patients, but mental health was something that really came up. So I worked with a team of clinical psychologists as well as another maternal health scientist, and we are building out a conceptual model that could grapple with racial birth trauma and how it relates to the mental health aspect of how patients experience clinical services, sickle cell services, and maternal and child health services.
So give us a sort of outline of how you went about your study, and then it would be great to kind of, if you can share some of the other things that you found, because I think you've got quite a diverse mixture of responses about what people felt about NIPT.
Yes. So at the NIPT study, it initially started with sickle cell populations. We were there at the NIH in the bottom lab. We already were doing studies with populations who are experiencing sickle cell disease. So we recruited from these populations, and we also partnered with a local NGO or a national NGO called Sacred Sickle Cell, or SCRED, which means Sickle Cell Reproductive Education Directive. Sacred. So SCRED. Yes, SCRED. So with SCRED, we were able to build out this study that analyzed patient perceptions across two different cohorts. The first cohort had sickle cell disease, or also had children with, had infants with sickle cell disease or a sickle cell trait. And then the second cohort, we analyzed Black women who did not have sickle cell disease. They were just as seen as our group, our comparison group. And the reason why I was very intentional about analyzing Black women as a single population study was because oftentimes in quantitative data sets, Black women are homogenized or seen as a monolith category, or they're seen as all of one lump, lumped together all as one group. And so for me and my research, I've tried to become very intentional about disentangling the variance between Black women as a means of humanizing the research process. There's a lot of variety within one's racial group. And one of the issues with research ethics and research injustice is that Black populations are lumped all together and dehumanized through the research process. So with analyzing Black women and the varieties of Black women, we collected demographic data across a range, a wide range of religion, region, ancestry, ethnicity, self-reported health, self-reported conditions. We also screened for income or their own perceptions of their income status, education status, partner status, married, divorce, education levels. It was very broad range. Pregnancy loss was also a part of our demographics, as well as their if they had an abortion or how they perceived abortion as well. So in that large group, we had about 40 to 41 women, and it was a really good, robust group that allowed us to see how that they might navigate a clinical vignette. And the clinical vignette was developed in our lab at NIH. The clinical vignette was also something that went through a rigorous level of assessments from other clinicians as well as OBGYNs across the nation. We spent about 8 months in the virtual field during the pandemic. Collecting data during COVID was very challenging, but it also gave us a really unique opportunity to lean in closer to women who were open on a virtual platform, who were able to share their stories with us virtually. And it allowed them a chance to connect with us from wherever they were. So we were able to not just collect data on the East Coast, but also we reached out toward populations on the West Coast and in the South. And if we were doing this in person, we would have been restricted. So during the times of virtual telehealth or virtual interviewing, it allowed us to expand our population in our study. One of the interesting aspects that came up with this data collection was the response rate. Our response rate was very high. And in the field of genetic studies, as well as clinical studies, there was a lot of discrepancy around trust, of course, rightfully so, trust and mistrust. But it was also seen or framed as though Black populations do not want to participate in scientific studies or genetic studies such as non-invasive prenatal testing because of fear or mistrust. And rightfully so, historically, this is definitely one of the dilemmas. But we noticed that in our study that the Black women were open. They were open. They were curious. They were very, very interested in participating in a study that was led by a Black woman researcher. And so this is something that's very interesting, because when we talk about bioethics and the margins, and we talk about marginalization, we also have to make sure that the scientists who are leading these studies, the researchers who are conducting these studies, also can be in relation or relatable to the communities that they serve. So we need to provide more opportunities and more approaches for scientists of color to lead these studies and to get funding for these studies to be conducted, so that patients are also seeing us in these roles as scientific researchers as well. So yes, our response rate was pretty amazing. And we also received a lot of not just recommendations for this work, but a lot of our patients really complimented the work toward the end of their interview. I remember one Black woman patient, she has sickle cell disease and two children. She says, "No one's ever asked me questions about my sickle cell and reproductive health experiences combined. They asked me one or the other." And she said that this work made her feel seen. It made her feel heard. And she really thanked me for holding space for her and her story. So that really inspired me to write another article on holding space in our research for patients who have these patient stories, but may not have ever had anyone ask them how they felt about these genetic advancements and these technologies. And the last point I'll say on that, in regards to these genetic technologies and the advancement, patients are curious about it, but they also feel, or speaking from the populations that I've studied, they are curious about these advancements, but they are also feeling neglected because they feel as though as these advancements are increasing, the lived experience is not changing. The lived experience on structural barriers, neglect, residential segregation, proximity to quality clinical services, implicit bias, racial bias at the clinical encounter, colorism at the clinical encounter. Some of our sickle cell patients have mentioned how they feel stigmatized, of course, at the clinical encounter. They feel that they have to hide their pain because they're Black. They are seen as drug seekers for wanting one or more pain to help alleviate the pain conditions and the pain crises. So that has not changed, but yet and still there's advancement in these genetic technologies. So patients are feeling very skeptical while they're feeling open and curious about these technologies. They're also feeling neglected on their lived experience as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I hear you. There's a lot of, you know, health disparities remaining and health equity issues that are not going to be addressed by just having more technology. So overall, some women seem to say they would never do the test. And other women were, you know, maybe I would do it. But what was your overall sense of how these might be? I mean, if these were in practice, would women want them or would they kind of forego them, do you think?
Yes. So in terms of this result, I thought this was very important and very critical to our study, that we had a split opinion or split vote. We had some women who were open to more testing, such as NIPT for sickle cell disease. And we had some women who were against it or felt as though, why do we need this type of screening? I just want to be able to enjoy my pregnancy without the issues of results from another predictive test, and it's only predictive. So women have the additional mental burden of having to make an important life decision or critical decision based on a predictive result. So we had some pushback from patients on that aspect, but there was a range. And I thought that this was a really good range because it allowed us to see the breadth and depth and the variety of perceptions in a single racial population that is often seen as monolithic. And I challenge the field to sit with this because oftentimes Black women are put into one category, such as on a quantitative measurement or a quantitative survey, check yes if you're Black or African-American, or self-report your race. And then in those categories, women are lumped together. But the beauty of qualitative research, and if it's done with intention, it allows us to disentangle and to see the nuances and the granular details that are often missed or not able to be addressed fully in quantitative research. And this is not about pitting or putting qualitative against quantitative. This is about which method best addresses your research question. And for me, my research question was about the lived experience and the patient's perceptions and the disentanglement within one single patient population or racial group. And so in terms of the results, for example, I will say we had two patients, and I'm just saying this as a highlight. We had two patients who had similar lived experiences. They both had sickle cell disease. They both were mothers. They both Black women. Very, very similar intersections, very similar demographics, but yet they still had two opposing or divergent views on the genetic technology. And I thought that this was very critical to understanding what this looks like when we talk about disentangling populations who are often put in one monolithic group. These two women had the same shared narrative or the same shared clinical demographic or clinical aspects, but two different perceptions, two different opinions, two different lenses of how they went about navigating and negotiating their decision, or how they would go about navigating their decisions around NIPT for sickle cell disease. We had the first woman, she mentioned, what's the point of this genetic technology? Why is this, you know, why do scientists or doctors need this information? What are they gaining from these results? She was very, very analytical and skeptical of the genetic technology. And again, there was no right or wrong perception. We encouraged our patients in the study to be open, to share their honesty, and to be very, very upfront with us about their feelings and their perceptions thereof. So the first woman, yes, she was definitely against it. And then the second woman, she was interested. She was definitely interested in the genetic technology. She felt as though because she had sickle cell disease, she also had a parent with sickle cell disease in her home, she wanted to lean toward NIPT for sickle cell disease. She said that because of its predictive value, she would still go for further testing. She would still go for further definitive testing or diagnostic testing, such as the amniocentesis. And so you see these two women, similar demographics, similar lived experience, but they have two different perceptions. And this allowed us to see the nuances and the variety and the texture of Black groups within group. And oftentimes Black groups are denied that variety. We're denied the variety or the variance to have opposing thoughts, to have thoughts that are that have resistance, thoughts that have hesitation. We're denied having thoughts that may be open to these different aspects. And so I thought that this result was very powerful, because not only did it show us the texture and the variety between women within the same racial group and the same genetic condition, but it also challenges the field and society to see the humanity within one racial group, the texture and the variety between persons. And it provides personhood to a population that has been historically denied personhood.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Thank you for sharing. And it's really fascinating, because obviously your work is in phenomenology, dealing with, of course, human experience and how we interpret those experiences, but also definitely has to do with a lot of epistemic injustice as well, regarding testimony, regarding voice, and not really listening to those voices who have historically have been oppressed or ignored or deemed to be incompetent. So explaining your experience and explaining, of course, your study, and really, you know, being boots on the ground, really literally being in these particular communities, in these circles, is really important. I'm curious if you found anything that has been surprising to you in your journey, in your particular studies, evaluating all of the demographics, but also the lived experiences of the individuals that you interacted with on a day-to-day basis. Were some things surprising to you, or really all of the same?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for affirmation of my work here. Thank you so much. What really surprised me, well, first and foremost, doing health justice research and health equity work, some of this stuff is definitely not surprising. I mean, I'm not shocked sometimes, and I hear these stories. But something that did surprise me, that, and I wouldn't necessarily call it a surprise, I would say I had to sit with it. It was discomforting. It was very discomforting. It was something that made me have to also seek my own therapist, to have to hold space for these stories of women at the clinical encounter. There was a patient in my study who, during her birth process, she recalled how the security guards had to escort her husband out of the birth room, or out of labor and delivery, because they were asking too many questions. The nurses felt threatened by their questions. The nurses felt as though their questions were overstepping their boundaries. The husband, you know, just wanted to know a little bit more information before they gave his wife this particular drug or this treatment, or went into this particular urgent process with their labor and delivery. And they felt threatened by the husband, who's a Black man. And so they called security on him. They called security on him and had him escorted out. So now she's this pregnant woman. She has sickle cell. This is her first child. And she has to give birth without her partner by her side because of this issue. After listening to that patient story, I had to take a few days, because we haven't talked about the criminality of Black bodies at the clinical encounter. The policing of Black bodies, especially when they have questions to their providers, questions about their health, questions about their treatment. It really bothered me a lot. I had to take some time, and, you know, as a scientific researcher, I'm writing these studies, and one of the issues is that the research to practice gap is so large. It's heartbreaking. We do these studies. It can take 2 to 3 years sometimes to do a really robust empirical analysis. And then it's published. And then what? It's, you know, just in the university setting or the academic setting, it's not reaching the populations that need it most sometimes. And so this discomfort, I use this discomfort to challenge me to be more thoughtful about reaching populations outside of science. And so I started using some of my own funding from my research budgets to have health workshops and health, you know, talent shows or art shows just for sickle cell patients. We did this in Ghana, where we had health workshops for our sickle cell patients. And it's just a moment for them to breathe, a moment for them to process, a moment to speak to other patients with their conditions. Oftentimes they're isolated or only seeing one provider at a time, but it allows them to see themselves as whole. We had one patient that came to our health workshop and she said she has no friends because she's always in the hospital or always at the clinic. And so she had no friends. She said she didn't know who to talk to other than providers. She grew up in the hospital because of her condition. And so at the health workshop, it was another sickle cell patient sitting right beside her. And she said, I'll be your friend. And they were able to just have a moment to just see each other. And I thought that that was very powerful for me to do science outside of the lab, to do science differently, to step outside of the center and just be in the margins, be on the ground. And so that spoke to my own heart posture. And it stemmed from these patient stories and the data, where I'm saying, sometimes I feel like I'm not doing enough. And I know I'm doing a lot already. I'm just one person, but I don't do this alone. I have a team of researchers that I've worked with who have challenged me. I am so indebted to them and they help keep this research moving forward. But it's those stories where criminality and policing come into play that really surprises me the most. And it's not a surprise. I think it's just deeply heartbreaking.
Yeah. Thank you so much, y'all, for sharing your advocacy or what you personally try to do to at least help alleviate these many different issues. And of course, it's complex, it's multifaceted based off of our histories and many other different social dynamics. So, but thank you, because of course, you did share an important point about we do the work and yes, you know, it's published in, you know, a peer-reviewed top-tier journal, which is good academically speaking, right? Because while we are all researchers and that is part of our, it's part of our job to do that. However, there is a certain elitism that is connected to that, that, okay, yay, we did the research, we got it published, but what are the results and the consequences that are still perpetuating themselves in society that this research is really not helping in a grander scale? And you definitely mentioned that. And again, we appreciate your advocacy in that regard. Based off of academia, however, how do you hope to help pave the way forward with the issues that you are advocating for and researching it?
Yes, thank you. This is for me a two-part mission. And I'll say this is an inner mission, a self mission. But before I share my two-part mission, I would like to mention that in terms of the way I've been able to navigate my career, my scientific career, I've been, one, yes, very intentional, but two, also very open to just being guided, but also stepping outside the box, taking a risk to do research differently. So I have a list that I make for myself, and I make a T-chart, and on one side, I put goals I'd like to accomplish in my career, goals that typically make sense. They're kind of linear, you know. And then on the other side, I have goals that are wow cards. These are goals that are very bold on purpose. They're very, you know, they challenge me to step outside my comfort zone. They challenge me to step outside of America. They challenge me to step outside of even my own language system, learning another language, so to speak. But these are goals that really, really push my gut, push my heart, and challenge me to be bold. And so I have this T chart, and I have the logical safe goals on one side and the wow goals on the other. And I do a mix of both. And so when I was able to do research differently, like have the healthcare workshops in Ghana, or, you know, going into different clinics and advocating for more, like having an art show for sickle cell patients, those are very wild goals that take funding, and it takes audacity, of course, but they, in a lot of spaces, have never really been done. We have these types of approaches for patients with cancer, but when it comes to patients with sickle cell disease, it's very limited and very restricted, because sickle cell is seen as, or framed as, a Black disease. And therefore, most things that are framed and seen as a Black disease are deprioritized and dehumanized and underfunded. And so now that we have this, you know, genetic technology on the rise, now sickle cell has taken much more of a center stage. But sickle cell has always been kind of, you know, in the margins. And so doing this very marginal work, I used to get very, very disheartened, because I'm like, who's going to see this? Who's really leaning in toward this research that we're doing? I'm reminded of the life of Toni Morrison. I was reading her book called The Source of Self-Regard, and she talked about the margins, and she mentioned how she is going to stay in the margins. And if you want to know more about her work, you'll come to the margins. And she stood her ground to stay in the margins with her life's work. And it challenged me to take the same stance. I'm going to be in the margins, and I'm going to have goals that make sense, but I'm also going to have goals that are bold and that are wild on purpose, so that it can push the field a bit forward. And in terms of your question about the mission, for me, it's an inner mission, and it's two part. The first part is patient facing, is provider facing, and creating modules and guidelines, ethical guidelines for understanding fertility, reproductive health as it relates to genetic technology, sickle cell disease, and training platforms for scientists and patients. And the second part of that mission for me is also developing researchers of color, and also having researchers of color who are exemplar in their own ways be seen and be heard and valued on research teams. So I am taking a stab at developing my own lab, SWAG Lab, Sickle Cell Women and Girls Research Lab. And it has really been such a very, very interesting time period to do this, but I realized that I've already been doing this work. I might as well go ahead and submit my R01 to continue to fund the work that I'm doing. And so far, I've developed and trained over 7 different research assistants between the United States and Ghana. And a lot of my research assistants have gone on to medical schools, public health, law school, have become, you know, NGO leaders. And so now this has really guided me to see myself as a lab leader. And that is a two-part mission for me to, yes, develop the research on sickle cell and reproductive health, but also to continue to develop the workforce in research and science.
Oh, yeah, that is simply amazing. And we just want to commend you on the work that you're doing. And I know that you have worked hard, of course, in academia. You had a commentary in the Hastings Center report. You also co-authored an article in the American Journal of Bioethics about social justice and anti-racism in bioethics research. And of course, you kind of answered this question already with some of the work that you're doing. And we did talk about the negative dynamics of this particular topic. But I'm curious, have you seen any positive movement leading, you know, in the right direction? And with that question, another question I will ask is, what gives you hope for moving forward? So not to be discouraged, but, you know, any light at the end of the tunnel, if you will, in regarding this particular, clearly an area that we need to improve within bioethics and bioethical research.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. So I guess to answer the first part of your question in terms of the positives, you know, I've always been the type of, I guess, the type of researcher who is very adamant about not providing pretty solutions. This is not pretty work. This is serious work that are impacting patients who are at a life and death situation or circumstance. So when people ask me for recommendations and solutions, I'm often pausing and I'm often hesitant. And I'm curious about my own hesitance. And I journaled about this because I do keep a journal that helps me write these publications. But in my journaling about my hesitation, I came to realize that people want these pretty solutions. They want these pretty and cute recommendations. And this is not pretty or cute work. So I was able to spearhead a commentary in Genomic Advances with a team. And we were able to talk about sitting with the discomfort and grappling with discomfort. And so not rushing to solutions without understanding the problem. I think we need to sit longer with the problem so that we can understand what's really happening at the clinical encounter before, during, and after the clinical encounter for patients who occupy multiple realities and multiple intersections. Yes, we want solutions, but I think the solutions are that we're not listening and that we also need to understand the structural dynamics that are at play and as it relates to power and hegemonic power and discrepancies as well. The second point of that, in terms of medical training, there is a cultural competency trainings that are provided to medical residents and in medical trainings, but we also need to push the envelope a little bit on those as well. There are scholars who see that as controversial, and I would like to push the envelope towards seeing more training on structural competency, and not just cultural competency. Structural dynamics and understanding the social implications that impact patients is very, very important. So I think for me, it may not be seen as positive right away, but it's en route. And for me, the route and the pathway is that we're moving in the right direction, one step at a time, of course. What gives me hope about this is I get a lot of fulfillment from the research that I do. And you don't hear the word fulfillment a lot. You don't hear the word fulfillment or joy a lot in research, but I get a lot of joy and fulfillment in the work that I do. I believe I'm built for the work that I do. One thing that inspires me are the patients themselves, because there are times I wanted to walk out the lab and give up on my own studies. There have been people who push back on my studies. I've been rejected so many times, and I reapplied or resubmitted and got accepted. My persistence has been something that is ancestral and something that is very personal to my own self mission. But the patients are who inspire me the most. I had one patient, she's 13 years old. She had sickle cell disease, or she has sickle cell disease, of course, and she makes beads for her family. Like, she's a bead maker and she makes bracelets and jewelry. And she made me a bracelet. And she came to me and she's like, Dr. Thomas, I made this just for you. Thank you for your sickle cell research. And that meant so much to me. Out of times I've been rejected from a publication or denied or missed a step or missed an ingredient and had to go back and sit in the lab or throughout my own tears, for a 13-year-old sickle cell patient to create a bracelet for me was like my own initiation into the field, because I feel that this is why I'm doing this work. This is why I'm having those sleepless nights. This is all worth it when I'm in a boardroom and someone challenges my research, or someone, you know, belittles the work that I do. I can always remember the 13-year-old patient who thought of me because I thought of her. And so it's, for me, I'm willing to go through whatever it takes to make sure her story and her life can be a bit better. So yeah, that's what gives me hope. And also having that wild side of my research goals, because it keeps me alive. It keeps me vibrant. It allows me to have my own style. You know, I'm not just, you know, doing this, you know, like any regular scientist. I'm going to do this like me. You know, I'm going to be my full authentic self in my research. If that means wearing hot pink boots to lab, I'm going to wear them. I'm going to be bold. I'm going to be myself, because I'm here to stay and I love what I do. So I'm going to do it how I do it.
Wow. Well, that's enough said. Thank you so much, Dr. Thomas, for your inspiring message, your inspiring work, and we're really grateful to have you.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. Lovely to have
you. Thank you for listening to another great conversation on Bioethics in the Margins. This podcast is hosted by Amelia Barwise and Kirk Johnson. Our producer is Elizabeth Chung. Our editor is Madeline Mahoney. Our theme music was written and produced by Pablo Cortes. We are grateful for the assistance of Wendy Jung, and Gargi Pandey is our creative director. Nicole Strand is our advisor, and Steven Sodecki is our senior advisor. Join us again next time.